And speaking of sentiment brings us very naturally to the Dovecote. That was the name of the little brown house which Mr. Brooke had prepared for Meg's first home. Laurie had christened it, saying it was highly appropriate to the gentle lovers who went on together like a pair of turtle doves, with first a bill and then a coo. It was a tiny house, with a little garden behind, and a lawn about as big as a pocket handkerchief in front. Here Meg meant to have a fountain, shrubbery, and a profusion of lovely flowers, though just at present the fountain was represented by a weather-beaten urn, very like a dilapidated slop bowl. The shrubbery consisted of several young larches, undecided whether to live or die, and the profusion of flowers was merely hinted by regiments of sticks to show where seeds were planted. But inside it was altogether charming, and the happy bride saw no fault from garret to cellar. To be sure, the hall was so narrow it was fortunate that they had no piano, for one never could have been got in whole. The dining room was so small that six people were a tight fit, and the kitchen stairs seemed built for the express purpose of precipitating both servants and china pell-mell into the coal bin. But once get used to these slight blemishes, and nothing could be more complete, for good sense and good taste had presided over the furnishing, and the result was highly satisfactory. There were no marble-topped tables, long mirrors, or lace curtains in the little parlour, but simple furniture, plenty of books, a fine picture or two, a stand of flowers in the bay window, and scattered all about the pretty gifts which came from friendly hands and were the fairer for the loving messages they brought. I don't think the Parian Psyche Laurie gave lost any of its beauty because John put up the bracket it stood upon. That any upholsterer could have draped the plain muslin curtains more gracefully than Amy's artistic hand, or that any storeroom was ever better provided with good wishes, merry words, and happy hopes than that in which Jo and her mother put away Meg's few boxes, barrels, and bundles. And I am morally certain that the spandy new kitchen never could have looked so cozy and neat if Hannah had not arranged every pot and pan a dozen times over, and laid the fire all ready for lighting the minute Miss Brooke came home. I also doubt if any young matron ever began life with so rich a supply of dusters, holders, and piece bags, for Beth made enough to last till the silver wedding came round, and invented three different kinds of dishcloths for the express service of the bridal china. People who hire all these things done for them never know what they lose, for the homeliest tasks get beautified if loving hands do them. And Meg found so many proofs of this that everything in her small nest, from the kitchen roller to the silver vase on her parlour table, was eloquent of home love and tender forethought. What happy times they had planning together! What solemn shopping excursions! What funny mistakes they made! And what shouts of laughter arose over Laurie's ridiculous bargains! In his love of jokes, this young gentleman, though nearly through college, was as much of a boy as ever. His last whim had been to bring with him on his weekly visits some new, useful, and ingenious article for the young housekeeper. Now a bag of remarkable clothespins. Next, a wonderful nutmeg grater, which fell to pieces at the first trial. A knife cleaner that spoiled all the knives. Or a sweeper that picked the nap neatly off the carpet and left the dirt. Labor-saving soap that took the skin off one's hands, infallible cements which stuck firmly to nothing but the fingers of the deluded buyer, and every kind of tinware, from a toy savings bank for odd pennies to a wonderful boiler which would wash articles in its own steam with every prospect of exploding in the process. In vain Meg begged him to stop. John laughed at him, and Joe called him Mr. Toodles. He was possessed with a mania for patronizing Yankee ingenuity, and seeing his friends fitly furnished forth. So each week beheld some fresh absurdity. Everything was done at last, even to Amy's arranging different coloured soaps to match the different coloured rooms, and Beth setting the table for the first meal. Are you satisfied? Does it seem like home? And do you feel as if you should be happy here? Asked Mrs. March, as she and her daughter went through the new kingdom arm in arm. for just then they seemed to cling together more tenderly than ever. "Yes, Mother, perfectly satisfied. Thanks to you all. And so happy that I can't talk about it," answered Meg, with a look that was better than words. "If she only had a servant or two, it would be all right," said Amy, coming out of the parlour, where she had been trying to decide whether the bronze mercury looked best on the whatnot or the mantelpiece. "Mother and I have talked that over, and I have made up my mind to try her way first. There will be so little to do that with Lottie to run my errands and help me here and there, I shall only have enough work to keep me from getting lazy or homesick," answered Meg tranquilly. "Sally Moffat has four," began Amy.
"If Meg had four, the house wouldn't hold them, and Master and Missus would have to camp in the garden," broke in Joe, who, enveloped in a big blue pinafore, was giving the last polish to the door handles.
"Sally isn't a poor man's wife, and many maids are in keeping with her fine establishment. Meg and John begin humbly, but I have a feeling that there will be quite as much happiness in the little house as in the big one. It's a great mistake for young girls like Meg to leave themselves nothing to do but dress, give orders, and gossip. When I was first married, I used to long for my new clothes to wear out and get torn, so that I might have the pleasure of mending them, for I got heartily sick of doing fancy work and tending my pocket handkerchief. Why didn't you go into the kitchen and make messes, as Sally says she does, to amuse herself, though they never turn out well, and the servants laugh at her," said Meg.
"I did after a while, not to mess, but to learn of Hannah how things should be done, that my servants need not laugh at me. It was play then. But there came a time when I was truly grateful that I not only possessed the will, but the power to cook wholesome food for my little girls, and help myself when I could no longer afford to hire help.
You begin at the other end, Meg, dear. But the lessons you learn now will be of use to you by and by, when John is a richer man, for the mistress of a house, however splendid, should know how work ought to be done, if she wishes to be well and honestly served."
"Yes, Mother, I'm sure of that," said Meg, listening respectfully to the little lecture, "for the best of women will hold forth upon the all-absorbing subject of housekeeping.
Do you know I like this room most of all in my baby house?" added Meg, a minute after, as they went upstairs and she looked into her well-stored linen closet.
Beth was there, laying the snowy piles smoothly on the shelves, and exulting over the goodly array. All three laughed as Meg spoke, for that linen closet was a joke. You see, having said that if Meg married that Brooke, she shouldn't have a cent of her money, Aunt March was rather in a quandary when time had appeased her wrath and made her repent her vow. She never broke her word, and was much exercised in her mind how to get round it, and at last devised a plan whereby she could satisfy herself. Mrs. Carroll, Florence's mamma, was ordered to buy, have made, and marked a generous supply of house and table linen, and send it as her present, all of which was faithfully done. But the secret leaked out, and was greatly enjoyed by the family, for Aunt March tried to look utterly unconscious, and insisted that she could give nothing but the old-fashioned pearls long promised to the first bride. That's a housewifely taste which I am glad to see. I had a young friend who set up housekeeping with six sheets, but she had finger bowls for company, and that satisfied her, said Mrs. March, patting the damask tablecloths, with a truly feminine appreciation of their fineness. I haven't a single finger bowl, but this is a set out that will last me all my days, Hannah says. And Meg looked quite contented, as well she might.
Toodles is coming, cried Joe from below, and they all went down to meet Laurie, whose weekly visit was an important event in their quiet lives. A tall, broad-shouldered young fellow, with a cropped head, a felt basin of a hat, and a flyaway coat, came tramping down the road at a great pace, walked over the low fence without stopping to open the gate, straight up to Mrs. March, with both hands out and a hearty, "Here I am, Mother. Yes, it's all right." The last words were an answer to the look the elder lady gave him, a kindly, questioning look, which the handsome eyes met so frankly that the little ceremony closed, as usual, with a motherly kiss.
"For Mrs. John Brooke," with the maker's congratulations and compliments. "Bless you, Beth. What a refreshing spectacle you are, Joe. Amy, you are getting altogether too handsome for a single lady."